And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply.
Hello, welcome to Interesting Conversations. I'm Wendy Jones. Today I'm delighted to welcome into the studio the novelist Tony White. Hello, Tony.
Hi, Wendy.
Before we start, we just need to say that you are a novelist, but you're also chair of Resonance. We just need to declare our interest.
That's right. I'm honoured to chair the board of directors of Resonance, but I am primarily a novelist.
And today we're here to talk about your new novel, Shackleton's Man Goes South. It's a very deep, rich, innovative novel, and it's also part of an exhibition at the Science Museum. It's published in collaboration with the Science Museum.
It's published by the Science Museum. It's the first novel they've ever published.
Oh.
Though they've been publishing for about a century, they've never published a work of fiction before, a novel.
We talk about the Science Museum in London, which has, is it 2.8 million visitors a year, and it's designed to celebrate human ingenuity.
That's the strapline, yes. The novel was published as their Atmosphere Commission for this year, which is a series of three commissions running over a five-year period. A couple of years ago, the visual artist David Shrigley was commissioned to do a big wall painting. And this year they commissioned they published Shackleton's Man Goes South as their Atmosphere Commission.
So it's available from the Science Museum, from a download from the Science Museum.
Yes, yeah. It was quite interesting to look at how, you know, publishing with the Science Museum might have impact on how we published. And so the novel is available free on their website as an e-book in various formats compatible with all or most devices. There's an exhibition about the book in the Atmosphere Gallery, which has various bits of print and ephemera relating to the background of the novel. And there's a sort of touchscreen ebook dispenser that's part of that exhibition as well. So visitors to the gallery can email themselves a copy of the book. And if, depending what device they're using, people can be reading the novel on their phone or iPad, say, even before they leave the gallery, you know, in a matter of seconds.
So a very ingenious publishing form that your novel has come out in.
Yes.
Let's talk about the content. Shackleton's Man Goes South is, well, I think it's cli-fi. Is that the right phrase? It's a new genre, it's faction and it's cli-fi. Would that be Tony?
New kind of designation, cli-fi, which is coined by a writer called Danny Bloom, who was trying to draw attention to particular kinds of fiction that were dealing with climate change. That's relatively recent, I think. Certainly, it didn't exist as a genre when I was writing the book.
It's a very new genre.
It's a very new kind of idea
that you could group books under climate fiction that also has a science fiction element to it.
Yes, but yes, exactly. And some bookshops, Foyles, for example, have a cli-fi section.
Do they already? Yes. So that's very quick, isn't it?
But with Shackleton's Man Goes South, I saw it as kind of a bit of literary fiction, really, when I was writing it. Though it was inspired by a work of science fiction that I found in the archives.
Yeah, this is what's very, very, very interesting about the book. The different chapters, some are actual factual writing about Shackleton, about your discoveries, and about climate change around Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And the other alternating chapters are about Emily and Jenny and her daughter Emily in the future, being their men going south, they're refugees, environmental refugees.
Yes.
So there's two very different strands in the book. It alternates.
That's right. And that was an important part of how the book came about. And both strands were inspired
by this story
that I found
by
George Clark Simpson, who's a very interesting and very overlooked British scientist of the 20th century, who had been part of Scott's ill-fated Antarctic expedition, but survived. Some people survived that expedition, and he was one of them. He was a meteorologist, when he came back, he became the longest serving director of the Met Office. He's a very, yes, very influential figure.
And ahead of his time.
Ahead of his time. And also, he, in common with many, many scientists who travelled to Antarctica in that golden age of heroic exploration, they were discovering fossils of what looked to them like tropical plants.
Yes.
And they knew that Antarctica hadn't moved, so they had to confront the fact that at some point it had been, they thought, a tropical continent. And so this, the idea of dramatic climate change, albeit over vast periods of time, geological periods of time, was something that they were confronted with. And what's interesting about Simpson, though for the rest of his career he continued to research climate change, is that his initial response was to write a science fiction story.
Yes.
About climate change and about the melting of Antarctic ice, leading to the, you know, destruction of the human race. It's a gripping little story that he wrote for a sort of shipboard. They called it a journal, a newspaper, the South Polar Times. In effect, it was a kind of scrapbook that they, all the members of the expedition, contributed to, which Shackleton had founded on an earlier expedition as a way of raising morale and for what we call knowledge exchange now. And so Simpson wrote this story called Fragments of a Manuscript, discovered by the people of Sirius during the exploration of the solar system, which is... this little story about climate change. And I found it fascinating that this had been sitting there in the archives, more or less overlooked, for a century.
It almost seemed undiscovered. You just found it slipped between the pages of a book. It seemed quite literally undiscovered.
Well, it was collated. I mean, it was collated in a manuscript, and I in a facsimile of the South Polar Times. What was kind of interesting about it for me as a writer was that, yeah, having in the open, the story that forms the opening chapter of the novel is a story called Albatopolis Disparu, which was a little kind of metafiction where I pretended to have discovered a manuscript in the archives at the Science Museum. And wrote this kind of parodic bit of Edwardiana, you know, a bit of parodic Edwardian science fiction. Having pretended to find something, you know, a lost story of some contemporary significance, I then did actually find this, a real,
yes,
lost manuscript, which was Simpson's story. And in order to explore the implications of that story, that, you know, that this Edwardian scientist was thinking about climate change and, yeah, writing science fiction about it.
For the first time, it seems that someone was considering climate change and what it might be.
It's very, very early days.
Yes.
The term climate change had been used in the sort of late 19th century, discussing agriculture in the United States. It's particularly interesting that Simpson uses that formulation, climate change, in his short story.
What is it? There's quite a few things that are extraordinary here. You also focus on Shackleton's, the exhibition to go to Antarctica, that, mm-hmm, very historically resonant, mm-hmm, and powerful story that really is very deep in the British psyche, I think. And people trying to get to Antarctica for the first time and how arduous and difficult it was. What a unique experience.
Yes, and the way that they documented those journeys, those explorations is fascinating. So they became these gripping stories that, as you said, are embedded in our kind of national kind of sense of ourselves, and also they on Shackleton's expedition of 1914 to 16, they took a movie camera, a photographer called Frank Hurley made, you know, essentially a documentary about the journey, which had been intended as a sort of fundraiser, you know, for,
yes,
when they got back, they could sort of, you know, people would pay to see the film. And what's sort of interesting now, at a point when Antarctica is seen as being at risk, you know, when the melting rates are kind of speeding up and etc., is that it's to look at those stories from 100 years ago now, you know, to see what kind of resonances they have for us today, which are surely kind of which seem to me to be different to the sorts of stories that were needed at the time. So with the, I mean, Shackleton's a kind of absolute stone cold hero, you know, an incredible figure. And but the kind of story that needed to be told about Shackleton's expedition during the First World War, you know, was this story of all saved, all well, you know, that he had this amazing heroic journey to South Georgia, where actually, if you sort of pull the camera back slightly, you see that actually people died on the expedition, but they were people who were associated with the second boat. But that was the story that the country needed at the time. But part of what I'm exploring in the novel is what kind of value might the Shackleton myth have for people in the future?
Well, in the future, people are still trying to get to Antarctica. In your novel, Shackleton's Man Goes South, it's still a very, very treacherous journey, environmentally, politically, in terms of safety. It's a very, very dangerous. And in a warmer world, people are going to Antarctica because it's more environmentally friendly and easier to live in than the hotter land and flooded land.
Yes, that's the idea the story of Emily and Jenny, who are kind of fleeing to Antarctica, is the kind of, I sort of flipped the polarity of the Shackleton myth, so they're fleeing to Antarctica instead of from it.
And it's still very difficult to get there.
Yes, yes, exactly. In parallel to that, the story of Emily and Jenny, who we follow as they arrive on South Georgia and try and find a way to get the next boat. In parallel to that, I also spoke to a number of contemporary climate scientists who are working now.
Yes, this is very interesting.
So we have a kind of fiction, a fictional narrative and a non-fictional narrative that eventually kind of collide. They're on a sort of collision course.
And what you say about contemporary scientists, that there's Shackleton were the first people on boats, were the first people to get to Antarctica. Now about 49,000 people a year go to Antarctica. And how important is that we don't go for the environmental effects on the subcontinent.
It's a continent.
Yes, okay,
that's
continent.
Right, yes.
And that actually, the other interesting thing was Antarctica is the most stable landmass. It was much more stable than Pangaea and Gondwana land, wasn't it? Much more stable. It's the most stable landmass on the planet, most unmoving.
Yes, it's stayed where it is for hundreds of millions of years, yes.
And because of huge climate change, about 400 to 500 million years ago, it was as hot as Florida is now, which is also quite an extraordinary range of climate over the planet.
Yes, exactly. And the what was interesting talking to contemporary climate scientists about Simpson's story, you know, saying, look, you know, this George Simpson, you know, famous scientist, meteorologist, was writing about climate change in Antarctica 100 years ago. And he envisaged this being something that would happen over, you know, tens of thousands of years, you know, dramatic climate change.
Yes.
And I was able to ask the, you know, contemporary scientists, what kind of timescale are we actually talking about? Yeah. And the answers were quite shocking, scary, you know, that you know, dramatic climate change in Antarctica is something that's happening on the first scientist that I spoke to said, you know, is you know, maybe centuries or thousands of years away, but every time I spoke to someone, it seemed the estimation of just how far into the future this was went down and down and down, until I finally met or spoke to a very interesting scientist called Peter Convey, who does a lot of work on the Antarctic Peninsula. And he was saying, actually, dramatic change is happening now, you know, we're all familiar now with this idea of, you know, that climate change can sort of be pegged at 2 degrees of warming or something if emissions targets are met and things like this. And Peter Convey was saying, well, actually, we're already, you know, in Antarctica, we're already way over that. And there's a sort of seasonal warming on the Antarctic Peninsula of 8 degrees, you know, already. And what he is studying down there is the impact of that on a very, very simple ecosystem where there may be one or two flowering plants, a grass and some lichen. And so for him, just the introduction of one additional species might... you know, constitute a dramatic change. But what was particularly kind of fascinating about what Peter was saying was this idea of his that in order to understand climate change futures, you know, in order to help us imagine climate change futures, one should look at how things are responding to change now. And for him, that meant looking at how this very simple ecosystem is responding to change now. But it could also mean, you know, that we can look at how human society is responding to change now, and to get a sense of what, you know, climate change futures might look like by the way that we're responding to change now. That opens up the understanding of what climate change looks like. You know,
it gives us some sort of possibility of predicting how we might respond. You say if the West Antarctic ice sheet melts, the sea levels will go up 6 meters. That's sort of on a practical level.
That's what I gather from British Antarctic Survey scientists, yes.
And your vision of the future, Tony White, is really chaotic and lawless, full of boundaries and laws that are held by people who are very lacking in integrity. It's a dangerous, violent world. It's a very regressed world socially, that you would see.
Yes. I mean, the world that Emily and Jenny are travelling in is a world where, I mean, effectively they're refugees, but they're being trafficked. I mean, they're being trafficked to Antarctica, and the, without sort of giving the story away, we don't know quite if they get there. It's left.
We don't even know if there is actually this place called Antarctica, which they can have some refuge in.
That's
don't know. We don't have a sense. So I didn't have a sense also of how far in the future it would be, but they felt reasonably contemporary people.
Yes, I wanted it to. I wanted to reflect the kinds of experiences of migrants today. It seemed to me that there was an interesting correspondence between Shackleton setting off in his little painted boat, from the ice, and you know, trying to get to South Georgia, and the thousands of people setting off in little painted boats on journeys that are every bit as kind of heroic and desperate.
An amateur.
As Shackleton's, but you know, these are the journeys that are being made from the northern coast of Africa, in the Indian Ocean. The world that they inhabit is very much the world of contemporary policy around migration. You know,
yes, that felt quite familiar from what I've read, that this. That the going across borders and travelling illegally is very, very difficult and treacherous.
Yes, and the novel is dedicated to 45 people who weren't the last 45 people by any means to die trying to get to Christmas Island, the Australia's offshore refugee detention centre, where in December 2010, when I was starting work on the novel, a boat containing around 50 people was wrecked on the rocks. You know, most lives lost.
Where were they coming from?
They were coming from Indonesia or Southeast Asia, there's not even a record of their names. You know,
right.
And no one knows quite how many people were on board, but they think that around 50 were killed trying to break into this detention centre on their way to Australia. And this is something that's happening. It seemed to me that this was an important thing to be writing about. Though it's kind of... it's desperate, you know, watching this kind of situation happening over and over again on Lampedusa and on Christmas Island. But if you take this idea of Peter Convey's that we, you know, to understand what climate change futures might look like when there will be a lot of migration, looking at the experiences of migrants now, was one way into to you know a possible kind of future, I suppose.
Sorry, I've hit the mic again. If there is climate change, it's not something that seems as if it's been very fully explored in literature. We call it polar literature or cli-fi. It's not something we've really considered imaginatively yet collectively.
Yes, there are millions of words written about climate change, but mainly in the context of scientific research.
As you say, it's very data heavy.
And governmental policy.
You were saying previously research on climate was very data light and theory heavy, and now it's very data heavy and much less theory heavy, sort of theory light.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phrase of Roger Molina, the editor of Leonardo magazine, that science used to be data poor and meaning rich,
meaning
and now
rich,
it's
that's right.
Data rich and meaning poor. It's certainly true that there's these vast suites of documents, you know, about climate change, published, you know, as scientific papers or through the workings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. But I've read quite a lot of that material in researching the novel, and it's fair to say that and this is not to kind of disrespect the scientists who write this work, but it's fair to say that if you want to read a good communicative story about climate change, you don't ask a committee of politicians and bureaucrats to edit that for you. So it seemed to me that actually using that data to tell different kinds of stories, to write a novel, was something interesting to do.
You could almost say about climate change, it's data rich and also novel poor. We haven't had time to really explore and digest and deal with it imaginatively. What, you know, looks like a possible scenario.
Yes, exactly. And so Shackleton's Man Goes South was an opportunity to explore that territory, but to try and do it in a way that would draw people in. It's been interesting, the feedback about the book. You know, people have said, what happened to Emily and Jenny? Do they get there? I keep imagining Emily and Jenny on Antarctica. So people kind of get attached to the characters.
It's a very gripping narrative. I want to know what's going to happen next. Where are they? What is this world they live in?
Yes, exactly. And as a writer, that's
what you
one
want.
Plays with that
you
kind
want
of
that, don't
those
you?
Ideas. So, to offset that with this non-fiction narrative, that's looking at exploring the implications of Simpson's story.
Yes,
it's kind of scientific journalism or
yes,
scientific
it is,
prose.
Yeah.
Hopefully, the two strands kind of illuminate each other as it unfolds.
Because I think without the story, with just the novelistic strand, you would only get a story without any context. How imaginative was this? Is there any base in reality for this scenario? And with the science, as we said, that needs illuminating more imaginatively.
And because these strands, these kind of types of writing seem initially to be quite far apart.
But they are,
it
really,
creates
aren't they?
A space for the reader to inhabit and to sort
that's
of fill out for themselves.
It demands. I was looking at your book, Tony, and it has history in it, research, science, novel writing, sci-fi, cli-fi, media, information, and short stories by other writers. It has many writing strands woven into it. It's rich. It's very rich text.
Yes, I mean, complexity is something that I think you need to, or one as a writer, one needs to kind of embrace complexity sometimes. Certainly to write this novel, because there's so much at stake and so much to kind of weave together.
And so few but presidents.
So few, yes. But also there's a need to do it lightly, to not... reproduce that same effect that all those IPCC documents have, which is to swamp you in huge narratives. So it seemed the
that's
idea.
There's no narrative half the time. That's very generous
yes.
of you.
Well, the but the this is where Simpson's story from 1911 was the kind of catalyst. This idea of fragments, you know, of a manuscript, and using fragments and broken pieces to kind of create a new story.
I'm very aware with science that all this extraordinary, fascinating research comes out, and so little of it seems to be put into books that are available to people who aren't scientists or aren't hugely scientifically knowledgeable, into books that are readable and your average reader can understand. There seems to be such a discrepancy from what's discovered scientifically and what's available beyond the sort of scientific elite. There's such a loss to us culturally and to us creatively in terms of solution finding.
Yes, and I think that was why it was so interesting working with the Science Museum, because
yes.
the where I had, I should say, I'd been writer in residence there, and that was where the earliest parts of the novel were written. And that's when I sort of found the Simpson story, etc. But working with the Science Museum and, you know, publishing Shackleton's Man Goes South with them enabled us to take the book directly to, you know, a huge potential readership.
And a scientifically interested readership.
People who are interested enough to go to the Science Museum.
In the first place, which and, is a lot of people.
Yes, and also to... what's interesting about working in with a museum as a publisher, you know, is that they have such a kind of detailed and nuanced understanding of who walks through their door, you know. So we were able to use that kind of audience research to inform how we published.
That's very. There's almost an argument for the Science Museum. You're the first novelist who's worked with the Science Museum as a writer in residence. There's almost an argument for the Science Museum in London for having constant writers in residence and many, many novels to explicate their knowledge in a much, much wider form.
I think the IPCC should have a writers in residence as well. Just have people working directly.
The
Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change.
With a name like that, they
UN
need
body.
A novelist to help them with their
yes,
clarity,
exactly.
don't they? They should have a novelist to.
I think the work that's generated by the IPCC, along with other huge kind of document archives that are being created in our contemporary world, the transcripts of the Hague tribunals, for example, these are huge, very important,
very
influential texts, but which are closed.
Yes,
and so writers and art, you know, taking writers and artists into those contexts. Just opens them up slightly to a different kind of scrutiny.
And they're texts that are very, very difficult to read and require a very specific sort of readership and imagine and understand it before they're accessible to you.
Yes, which is where going, you know, sort of sometimes blundering in as a writer enables you to discover things that the experts might not have noticed.
And it gives something to the experts as well because you've played with their material in different ways.
Yes, and so far that seems to have been welcomed.
Does it? Oh,
yes.
that's really good.
With the,
to hear.
The scientists that I've been doing events with a number of IPCC authors, you know, at literature festivals and things, and they've all been very open to the sort of liberties that I've been taking with the scientific research in the novel.
Tony, it sounds such extraordinarily important work to write novels about this new information, so we can understand it. More people can understand. More people can be involved in the solution.
Exactly, it's a hidden part, a hidden but, you know, vitally important kind of part of our world today. So it's up for grabs.
Your novel, Tony White, Shackleton's Man Goes South, is out now. It's available in the Science Museum shop.
It's available from the Science Museum shop in paperback exclusively, on the Science Museum website, you can download it, or you can email it to yourself from within the museum. My website has all the links.
And your website?
My website is pieceofpaperpress.wordpress.com.
Okay, and it's an extremely rich, innovative, exciting novel about climate change. I have never come across a book like it. So, well, thank you so much, Tony White, for coming into the studio today.
Wendy, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. This has been interesting conversations.